Shalom, welcome back. Before we continue on to part two, I wanted to cover something that I had not touched on in the first part. There's a lot of things that we're covering, a lot of concepts. I simply don't have the time to cover every single one of them. A lot of these things have been covered in previous teachings that Rico has done. If you do not understand something, please get on the forum and ask the question. Alright, now, continuing on with part two, Shadows of the Kingdom, Shavuot in the Book of Ruth. We're going to start by going over the meanings of the names of the characters that we find in the Book of Ruth. To start off with, we have Elimelech, who's the husband of Naomi. Elimelech means, my El is king. Get that from breaking down the word Eli, which is my God, or my El, and Melech is the word for king. Naomi means pleasant. Machlon, which is the first son, means sick. Kilion means destruction. Orpah means nape of the neck or stiff-necked. Ruth means friend. The name of the city is Beit Lechem, which is the house of bread. Ephrates means prince or aristocrat, and also is sometimes used for another term for the town Beit Lechem. Boaz, the redeemer, means strength is within him. And then we have the final character whose name doesn't actually appear in the English. He's referred to as the other redeemer in chapter 3, and he's the one that Boaz has the confrontation with in chapter 4. What you might see in your text is that so-and-so is done something, and that's in chapter 4. In the Hebrew, the word is Peloni Almoni. And that's what we're going to be referring to him as. And in chapter 3, he's also called Tov, or good. But I'll be referring to him as Peloni Almoni. Now, like I said, this name Peloni Almoni means so-and-so, or obscure and silent. And when you look into the etymology of the word, Clark's Dick Commentary talks about this as a term used for an individual who is known, but his name and residence is unknown. It's a term that implies criticism. Kind of like if we called someone a John Doe, not because we couldn't find out their name, but because they're so unimportant that we just assign a name that means nothing. So it's a critical term that the author of this book uses to imply something's wrong with this character. All right, so we start off in Ruth 1 verses 1. And I'm going to be reading from the Young's Literal Translation to pull out something from the text here. And it says, "And it came to pass in the days of the judging of the judges that there was a famine in the land, and there goeth a man from Beit Lechem, Judah, to sojourn in the fields of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons." Now, I point this out, I use this translation because of its literal translation of the judging of judges. This terminology is very similar to some terminology used in the book of Judges. In chapter 17, verse 6, again in 18, verse 1, 19, verse 1, and 21, verse 2, those chapters start out with, "In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." So the term judging of judges and the doing of what is right in your own eyes implies a state of lawlessness, a state similar to where we're at today. People just want to do what they want to do. They don't care what's morally right. It's whatever pleases them that is what they want to do. And part of the Oral Torah I believe this is from the Talmud, Bava Basra 15b. There's a section that states, "Woe to the generation that judges its judges. When the judge said, 'Remove a splinter from between your teeth,' and the accused said, 'Remove a panel from between your eyes.'" So that, as I'm sure you note, is very similar to Yeshua's words in Matthew 7, where he says, "Do not be judged, lest you be judged. For with what judgment you judge, you shall be judged. And with the same measure that you use, it shall be measured to you. Why do you look at the splinter in your brother's eye, but do not notice the plank in your own eye? Or how is it that you say to your brother, 'Let me remove the splinter from your eye,' and see, a plank is in your own eye? Hypocrite! First remove the plank from your own eye, and then you shall see clearly enough to remove the splinter from your brother's eye." So this is the condition. Everyone's trying to judge everyone else, telling them what's right, but they want to do whatever they deem pleasing to themselves, which is a form of Baal worship. If you've been following Rico's videos on ancient Near Eastern covenants, I believe it's in part 3, he talks about how Baal worship is actually a lifestyle. The worship of a deity is all about your lifestyle. So if you're worshiping Yahweh, you're worshiping him through your lifestyle. It's not just some expression off your lips. That's part of it. But the main part is how you live your life is worship. And when you're doing what's right in your own eyes, you are not worshiping the King of heaven and earth. You're worshiping a false husband, a Baal. One more thing to note from this verse is that it says there was a famine in the land. Now, Jewish commentary on this verse states that whenever the Bible talks about there being a famine of food in the land, there usually is a following famine of the word in the land as well. And that kind of makes sense when we look back at that judging of judges, people doing what's right in their own eyes. So let's talk a little bit more about this character, Elimelech. Now, this term may, or this name may sound very familiar to you, because back in Genesis, there was a similarly sounding name, except for it was Abimelech. Now, Abimelech means "my father, the king." And this was the term of the man, or this was the name of one of the people that Abram entered into a covenant with. And then if you remember, later on Yitzhak enters into a covenant with a person of the same name, Abimelech. From this, we can kind of deduce that this was not merely someone's name. This was a title. And Elimelech was not just an ordinary man. With a title such as this, this meant he was a wealthy man. He was a leader in his community. And back in those days, the community was made up of relatives. So he was kind of probably the tribe leader for the town of Beit Lechem. So we know that means that he was an aristocrat. He was of noble birth for that time. And so drawing off of that, Jewish commentary believes that Orpah and Ruth were actually nobility as well. They believe that they were the granddaughters of King Eglon. So Elimelech leaves. Since we know that he must have been a very rich man, it's interesting that he leaves, even though he probably had quite a bit of food. Instead of providing his food for his community, it seems that he was abandoning them because he did not want to help out and provide food for those poorer than himself. He wanted to hoard his own wealth, which goes back to every man doing what's right in his own eyes. He was more worried about his own well-being than the well-being of his fellow countrymen and his extended family, for that matter. The term Ephratim is how it is in the Hebrew. While we did talk about that being an aristocrat, it's important to note that Jewish commentary also recognizes this as a term that is often synonymous with Ephraim, the leader of the 10 northern tribes. And then one more interesting thing that I picked up on this is why did Elimelech and his family go to Moab? Normally, when there's a famine, biblical characters always flee to Egypt. It's the traditional place to go when there's a famine. However, Moab is not. But if we understand that Elimelech was fleeing because he did not want to share, it makes sense that he would go to Moab because they were infamous for their lack of generosity. And that's exactly the motive of Elimelech. And we also see that Moab is eastward of Israel. So this is also a picture of Elimelech and family going eastward, going away from Yahweh. So in this story, we know that Elimelech dies pretty soon after getting to the land, and his sons marry Orpah and Ruth, and subsequently die 10 years later, childless. And after so many months or years or however long, Naomi decides to head back to the land of Israel because she's heard that God has turned around the misfortunes and has provided bread for his people. Now it's interesting, she doesn't try to dissuade Orpah and Ruth at first. They begin to all journey back together. And then somewhere along the way, suddenly Naomi starts to say, hey, I'm not going to be able to have any more sons, so you're going to need to, go back to your land. And in fact, Naomi tries to discourage them from coming back with her three times. Now, any of you that have looked into Judaism at all know that within Judaism, it's customary to discourage a convert three times very strongly from following the Torah before they will convert. So, of course, Jewish commentary will say, well, look, see, they were following the Oral Torah here. My personal opinion is that the Oral Torah was based off of this verse, not that this verse was based off of the Oral Torah. But regardless of that fact, we can see that the number three is a messianic number. The discouraging verse three, she discouraged them three times, and three is a messianic number. So we know that this whole book has something to do with the Messiah. Another thing to draw from that is that if we're starting to see who Naomi represents allegorically, we can kind of see that she's starting to look like she represents Judah in this story. So Orpah, after trying to be discouraged twice, leaves. And specifically after hearing there's no inheritance for her, she decides, well, I'm heading back because no money, no land for me. I don't want to live the life of a common servant. So she heads back. And remember, her name meant stiff-necked. So she seems to be like the Israelites of old, who, when they heard that it wasn't going to be such an easy ride in the land, they decided they wanted to head back. Naomi, on the other hand, Ruth, on the other hand, it says, clung to Naomi and pledges an oath to her. Now, when you go into the Hebrew and look at the word clung, it is terminology that is used for an intense commitment, very intense. The Hebrew word is dabach. And there's an example of this in Deuteronomy 10, verse 20. So let's turn there real fast. And it says, "Fear Yahweh your Elohim, serve him, and cling to him, and swear by his name." All of those terms there are all covenantal language. And we again have it in Psalms 119, verses 31, where it says, "I have clung to your witnesses, O Yahweh, do not put me to shame." So once again, part of covenant making includes having witnesses. So again, we have this covenantal terminology used. And then, of course, the most famous use of clung comes from Genesis 2, verses 24, where it states, "For this cause a man shall leave his father and his mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." So, very obviously, this is covenantal language. And following this statement, it said that Ruth made an oath where she said, "Do not urge me to leave you or go back from following you. For wherever you go, I go. And wherever you stop, I stop over. My people is your people." Or sorry, "Your people is my people. And your Elohim is my Elohim. Where you die, I die. And there I shall be buried. Yahweh, do to me and more also, for death itself parts you and me." Now, this isn't just language that, you know, is trying to be flowery and nice. This is covenantal terms, like I've been saying. They were forming a blood covenant. And, you know, maybe they didn't swap blood, but it's the same concept. If you studied anything of blood covenants in Henry Clay Trumbull's books, you'll know this is an intense bond. This is closer than actual milk brothers, is how he uses the term. People who are born from the same mother and father are not as close as someone who comes into a blood covenant. Another terminology you could use for this is a personal parity covenant, if you've been studying ancient Near Eastern treaties. This language shows that from now on in this story, we can consider Ruth and Naomi essentially sisters, not just a mother-in-law and daughter. They were very, very close after this. All right, so let's talk about Ruth a little bit. The Torah, the book of Ruth specifically calls out Ruth as being a Moabite six times. Now, when you look into the Jewish commentary, they state that there's a ruling in the Oral Torah that states that a Moabitess may enter and not a Moabite, because the whole thing, when you go back to Deuteronomy 23, is that Moab failed to provide hospitality on the road, and that was a male's duty. So therefore, it's only a restriction against males. And they state that only Boaz knew this ruling, and everyone else didn't know that ruling, which, of course, is a bunch of rubbish. What I think is the most important thing here is that the text clearly wants us to see that Ruth is a Moabite. She is someone who, according to our understanding of the Torah, does not belong in the covenant. Now, you know, if you've listened, I think, you know, Brad Scott's talked about this, that obviously when you choose to accept Yahweh into your life, it doesn't matter your nationality, that you become Israel, which is correct. But regardless of that, the text belabors the point that she was a Moabite. And that's going to be very important coming up in the study that we're doing. Ruth was married to Mahlon while he was in the East, out in the diaspora, or the exile. So technically, Ruth was part of the covenant while married to Mahlon. But when he died, she essentially lost it. And what we're supposed to see is not that she was in covenant at the time, but she was entering into covenant. And also, Ruth was a descendant of Lot. Now, if you remember back from part one, we talked about Lot was originally in the covenant that Yahweh made with Abram. But there was disunity in the camp between Lot and Abraham, and they split into two kingdoms. And now we see Ruth is a descendant of that lost kingdom from Lot. Very important points, and we're going to tie all of these points together coming up later on, but I just want to make sure that we understand that Ruth was someone who, according to our understanding of the Torah, should not be allowed in the kingdom, and yet she is allowed in the kingdom, and later on she's actually part of the lineage of Messiah. So she's a very part of the kingdom. She's an integral part of the kingdom. All right, let's move on to chapter 2 of Ruth. This is kind of interesting. You know, Ruth goes up to Naomi and says, "Let me go gather in the fields and glean the grain." If you remember the law in the Torah that states, you know, that you leave your the corners of your field for the poor and the widows. So she would have been out there gleaning those. Leftovers, basically. And then it says that she accidentally came into Boaz's field. No divine inspiration there, but we can kind of see that the hand of Yahweh was behind all of this all along. Boaz comes from Beit Lechem, so that associates Boaz with Beit Lechem. And he greets his servants in the name of Yahweh. I'm going to go off on a little side tangent here on this, because I did find this interesting when I was looking this up. The Mishnah Berachot 9 verses 5 confirms that there was no prohibition against pronouncing the name, and it was in fact recommended using the name in routine greetings of a fellow Jew. However, by the time of the Talmud, it was the custom to substitute names for God. And that's from the website JewFact.org. You can see the URL down there below. And I just wanted to touch on that because I'm not saying that you have to say the name and, you know, it's completely silly to argue about the right way to pronounce it, and especially to disagree and to divide over pronouncing the name. But I did want to point this out because, you know, if you do get, someone does confront you on this, especially someone from the Judaism side, you can point out to them that, hey, look, even the Mishnah points out that this using the name of Yahweh was even used in common greetings back in the time of Boaz. So there obviously was not this stigmata about pronouncing the name. But once again, it's up to you if you want to pronounce it. If you don't want to pronounce it, just please don't render judgment on a brother because he chooses to pronounce it or doesn't pronounce it the way that you pronounce it. Let's learn to live as a kingdom and focus on the more important things. All right, getting back to the story, Boaz inquires of Ruth. And his servant tells him about Ruth, and so he goes up to her and confronts her, and tells her that he's heard all these wonderful things about how she's treated Naomi, and that he wants her to only glean from his field. So upon hearing this, Ruth prostrates herself in front of him and says, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should notice me, seeing as I am a foreigner?" Now that statement sounds very familiar to a story that Yeshua told about a prodigal son who, upon returning to his father's house, does not feel that he's worthy to receive the gifts that the father is bestowing on him. And he says, you know, just let me be a servant. I'm not worthy of this, just like Ruth does. So we can kind of connect Ruth with the prodigal son here. And we know that the prodigal son represents Ephraim, the son that was kicked out of covenant and now is returning. All right. So Boaz, his kindness towards Ruth, sorry, I already discussed that. So let's see. Let's go to verse Ruth 2, verse 12. Ruth states, Yahweh repay your work and reward, and your word is complete from Yahweh, Elohim of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge. Sorry, that was Boaz saying that to Ruth. So just remember that that seeking refuge under the wings of Yahweh. We'll come back to that in a little bit here, connecting that into something with verse 3. And then in verse 13, Ruth responds, let me find favor in your eyes, my master, because you have comforted me and have spoken to the heart of your female servant, though I'm not like one of your female servants. Now, this same terminology is used in the book of Hosea, chapter 2, and we'll go down to verse 14 here. Let me pull that up. This is Yahweh speaking to the rebellious house of Israel that he just divorced, and he states, therefore, see, I am alluring her, and shall lead her into the wilderness, and shall speak to her heart, and give to her vineyards from there, and the valley of Achor as a door of expectation. And there she shall respond as in the days of her youth, as in the day when she came up from the land of Mitzrayim. So you can see the connection there, speaking to the heart. Yahweh is speaking to the heart of the divorced house of Israel when he's trying to woo them back. And here Boaz is speaking to the heart of Ruth. All right, getting back to chapter 2. Very interesting. The next thing that Boaz does is he invites Ruth to a meal that consists of bread and sour wine. Now, if you've been studying into covenants, you'll notice that the terms bread and sour wine or vinegar here, but it is wine, were used when making a covenant. So we can kind of deduce here that Boaz was offering Ruth this filled, and then which was basically giving her a royal grant covenant to exclusively glean from the fields of Boaz, and then to seal the deal, they eat a covenantal meal. Ruth returns home to Naomi, and Naomi's very excited because she realizes that Boaz is a relative of theirs, and she states that he is one of our redeemers. So we can kind of see that Boaz had a specific role in the clan, the role of a redeemer. And if you remember back to part one of this series, we talked a little bit about a redeemer, how they would redeem the wives of or the widows. They would redeem the land, and they would also right any blood loss that happened. All right. And then last little thing to point out with, you know, in chapter 2, it finishes up with, in verse 23, it says, and she stayed close to the young women of Boaz to glean till the completion of the barley harvest and the wheat harvest, but she dwelt with her mother-in-law. And then in chapter 3, we're going to see that we start off in this threshing floor. So it wouldn't make any sense for Boaz to be down on the threshing floor after all the harvest was done. He probably would have been down there during the harvest. We kind of tell that chapter 2 is not necessarily in chronological order with chapter 3. All right, moving on to chapter 3. Chapter 3 is the heart of the book of Ruth. And we can tell that because it's at the center of a chiastic structure. I have this laid out here on the slide. You can see chiastically, Elimelech and his family are mentioned, and at the end of the book of Ruth, David and his family. Then we've got Naomi loses her children, and a child is born to Naomi. Ruth is a Moabite, and then Ruth was equated to Rachel and Leah. Orpah leaves. Peloni Almoni, the false redeemer, drops his claim. Naomi complains about being unworthy. Naomi confirms Ruth's election. Ruth proves worthy in the field, and then Ruth proves worthy and receives the gift of barley, and then right at the center is Boaz's meeting with Ruth on the threshing floor. Now, this meeting was very, very wrong. When you start looking into what exactly threshing is and winnowing, you'll see that this whole scenario is not made up for, is not what we would normally see if someone was winnowing barley. What winnowing is, let's start off with threshing. What they would do is they would take the barley and they would pound it to basically break the chaff off from the kernel of the barley. So then they'd be left with this big mixture of chaff and barley kernels. And they wanted to get rid of the chaff. So then they would winnow. They would take these big, they look like rakes, essentially. You can see it here in the picture. And these are actually small ones from the picture. They're usually a lot bigger. And they're called a fan, a winnowing fan. And they would take scoop up a big amount of it, and they'd throw it up in the air. And then the heavier kernels would fall back down into the pile, but the wind, and this would have to be obviously be done on a windy day, the wind would blow the chaff away, and so it would remove all the chaff. So now we come to this encounter with Boaz and Ruth, and we see that Ruth has to go down to the threshing floor. Well, that doesn't make for good winnowing if you have to go down underneath, because obviously the wind isn't going to blow through there. So she goes down to this pit-like area. It's also at night, and at night, wind tends to be died down. So normally they would not be doing winnowing during the night. So then she gets down there, and Boaz, who obviously has many servants, is down there winnowing alone. A rich man doing the winnowing alone obviously doesn't make sense. But it does make sense when you see Boaz as a messianic character and you see him here in the pit doing the role of a servant. And then finishing up, Boaz sleeps in the pit instead of going home. You know, another odd thing for a rich man to do. And winnowing is a very prophetic statement in the Bible. Let's look at a couple verses here. We'll turn to Isaiah for chapter 41, starting verse 14. Who has performed and who has done it? Calling the generations from the beginning, I, Yahweh, the first, and with the last, I am He. Coastlands see it and fear. The ends of the earth are afraid. They draw near and come. Let everyone say to his neighbor, be strong. All right, obviously I do not have the right Oh, sorry. I was reading from verse 4. Let's go down to verse 14. Do not fear, you worm of Yaakov, you men of Yisrael. I shall help you, declares Yahweh, and your Redeemer, the set-apart one of Yisrael. See, I am making you into a new threshing sledge with sharp teeth. Let you thresh and mountains and beat them small, and make the hills like chaff. You winnow them, and the wind lifts them up. The whirlwind scatters them. But you rejoice in Yahweh, and boast in the set-apart one of Yisrael. All right, next verse, we're going to go to Jeremiah chapter 15, verses 5 through 7. For who has compassion on you, O Yerushalayim, and who mourns for you? And who turns aside to ask how you are doing? You who have forsaken me, declares Yahweh, you have gone backward. Therefore I shall stretch out my hand against you and destroy you. I have been weary and relenting, and I shall winnow them with a winnowing fan in the gate of the land. I shall bereave, and I shall destroy my people. They do not turn back from their ways. All right, let's go to Psalm 1 verse 4, the wrong are not so, but are like chaff, which the wind blows away. And we'll finish up here with the words of our Master Yeshua in Matthew chapter 3, verse 11 through 13, where he states, I indeed immerse, or is this Yeshua speaking? No, sorry, this is Yochanan speaking of Yeshua. I indeed immerse you in water unto repentance, but he who is coming after me is mightier than I, whose sandal I am not worthy to bear. He shall immerse you in the set-apart spirit and fire. His winnowing fork is in his hand, and he shall thoroughly cleanse his threshing floor and gather his wheat into the storehouse. But the chaff he shall burn with unquenchable fire. So obviously, we do not want to be the chaff. We want to be the wheat. We want to be the barley. All right, so Ruth waits until Boaz is asleep, and then she comes down onto the threshing floor, and she uncovers his feet and lies down there. Now, why would she uncover his feet? Some commentaries, and I'm not joking, actually believe that this is a sexual innuendo, that she did something that we won't really discuss, but did something not so modest. But this just comes from a complete lack of context and a complete misunderstanding and lack of knowledge about the Torah. Obviously here, what she's doing is the duty of the woman in a Levirate trial. If you remember, if the brother refuses to marry his deceased brother's wife, then the wife removes that brother's shoe and spits in his face. So what we see here is when Ruth comes down there, she removes that shoe, she uncovers his feet, and basically, this is her initiating the, hey, are you going to do this duty? I've already taken your shoes off. All I've got to do is spit in your face, and from now on, you're going to be called the one who is without a shoe. So Boaz wakes up and obviously realizes what's going on here. He praises her for doing this. He's saying, he calls her a virtuous woman for doing this. And then Ruth begs him, now please spread your kanaf, your covering, over your female servant, for you are a redeemer. So now, if you remember back when I was talking in chapter 2 about Boaz telling Ruth that she is to seek refuge under the wings of Yahweh, the same word there, the wings, the kanaf of Yahweh, And now we have Boaz being asked to spread his kanaf over his female servant. So clearly we're hinting at that Boaz's character is messianic. He's related to Yahweh there. And then another thing that we can glean from that is that the kanaf, the corners, is where the tzitzit would have been tied onto. So by asking him to put his tzitzit over her, it was another way of saying, of reminding him that, or tzitzit are to remind you to keep Yahweh's commandments. So when Ruth asks him to put his tzitzit over her, she's reminding him that he needs to keep Yahweh's commandments, which is to redeem her. Which he, of course, does. So Ruth maintains her virtue. She basically completes the work that Tamar should have done, remaining virtuous, instead of using trickery and harlotry to secure the rights of the marriage. She uses virtue and never once enters into a sexual relationship with Boaz prior to being redeemed and married with him. And this, Ruth, we should see her as a picture of who the bride of Yeshua should, or what the bride of Yeshua should be like. So we see that the bride of Yeshua should be a virtuous bride, not resorting to trickery in order to bring about his kingdom, but following in his commandments. And then at the last little thing here in this encounter is that Boaz brings up there's actually another redeemer that's closer than he, and they're going to have to see if this redeemer wants to redeem Ruth instead of Boaz. So this mentioning of Tov or Poloni Almoni being this other redeemer kind of represents a trial for Ruth. It's to see, you know, are you going to remain virtuous when you, in the light of the fact that there might be someone else other than me? Here, and one thing I forgot to cover here is Boaz was asleep in the threshing floor, which is down in the earth. It's a pit. Boaz is asleep in the pit, and Ruth awakens him, and he redeems her. During this time. So that's kind of a picture of Messiah being in the belly of the earth. And we're going to tie all those parts together in part 3. So stay tuned for that. Alright, so let's go on to the next interesting part in chapter 3. Once this this whole encounter is done, you know, Boaz maintains Ruth's virtue and kind of, I don't want to say sneaks her out, but, you know, lets her out so that no one sees that she spent the night here. And he gives her 6 measures of barley. So I was looking into why 6 measures of barley. Well, it just so turns out that the word for barley is the same Hebrew consonants as the word for gate. A sheen, an ayin, and a resh. So when we look into this statement here, let's go to Ruth verses, or chapter 3, verses 17. She said, "And he gave me these 6 measures of barley, for he said to me, 'Do not go empty-handed to your mother-in-law.'" The word measures there is in italics, which means it doesn't exist. He gave her 6 of barley, 6 of something of barley. Which, you know, in reality, yes, she really got 6 measurements of barley. But we can kind of go into a sod level and look at it relating the word gate to barley. And we see that this messianic character, Boaz, gave Ruth 6 gates. Now, 6 gates, when you look at the New Jerusalem, would be half the kingdom. And who is it that's blessed with the double portion? Ephraim. Ephraim is given the double portion. So here we can kind of see another little allegorical reference to Ruth being linked with Ephraim. And another thing that reminds me, looking at the number 6, which the number 6 is the number of man, but Yeshua in John chapter 4 meets the Samaritan woman at the well at the 6th hour and discusses her 6 husbands with her. So another kind of interesting connection there. Now let's go back a little bit up to verses... Verse 16, Ruth chapter 3, verse 16. And when she came into her mother-in-law, she said, her mother-in-law says, "Is that you, my daughter?" And she explained to her all that the man had done to her. Well, if you look at the Hebrew, and some of the translations translate this properly, she didn't say, "Is that you, my daughter?" She said, "Who are you, my daughter?" Now, you know, people say, "Oh, well, you know, she recognized her because she used the word my daughter." Well, no, that's not necessarily the case, because earlier on, when Boaz talks to Ruth, he also calls her my daughter. So we can kind of deduce it's just a terminology used at the time to refer to a younger woman. So let's key in on that. Who are you? Ma'at bati, it is in the Hebrew. Ruth had just came back from being redeemed personally, the promise of redemption from Boaz, and when she walks in, Naomi does not recognize her. Very, very interesting. Because you know what? When we turn to Yeshua's day, Yeshua came for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. He came for the 10 northern tribes. And when he brought them back in by redeeming them, what's the first thing that the Pharisees if you look at Rico's teaching on House of Hillel versus the House of Shammai, this was a ruling of the House of Shammai that the Pharisees did not recognize the returning northern tribes. They said anyone who is a Gentile is not allowed into the kingdom. They did not recognize their returning brother. And here again, we see Naomi not recognizing her returning daughter-in-law. Very, very interesting connection there. Going back to the barley... one little thing I forgot to, or two things I forgot to cover that are very important with the barley. The gift that that Boaz gave Ruth was for Naomi, and the reason why he would have given this to her is to kind of signify to Naomi that even though that Boaz and Ruth are going to be married, Naomi is going to be a important part of both of their lives. And the reasoning behind this would be because Naomi was actually an eligible person to be redeemed by Boaz. So technically, Naomi could have been competition for Ruth, and yet she willingly gave her position or her right of being redeemed to Ruth. And then the last thing was very interesting for me, the freeing of a servant. Now, if you go to Deuteronomy 15 verses 13. Let's go there real fast. Let's go up to verse 12 for context. When your brother is sold to you, a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman, and shall serve you for 6 years, then you let him go free from you in the 7th year. And when you send him away free, let him not go away empty-handed. You shall richly supply him from your flock and from your threshing floor and your winepress with all which Yahweh has blessed you to give to him. So Ruth was being set free. She was being redeemed. And she was given a gift. Very, very important connection there. When you look at Messiah freeing us and redeeming us. Because when you turn to Isaiah chapter 11, verse 14, speaking here, let's see. Let's go up to verse 11. This is a very powerful prophetic message. And it shall be in that day that Yahweh sets his hand again a second time to recover the remnant of his people who are left from Ashur to Mitzrayim, from Pathros to Cush, from Elam to Shinar, from Hamath and from the isles of the sea. And he shall raise a banner for the nations and gather the outcasts of Israel and assemble the dispersed of Yehuda from the four corners of the earth. And the envy of Ephraim shall turn aside, and the adversaries of Yehuda be cut off. Ephraim shall not envy Yehuda, and Yehuda shall not trouble Ephraim. But they shall fly down on the shoulders of the Philistines toward the west, and together they will plunder the people of the east, their hands stretching forth from Edom and Moab, and the children of Ammon shall be subject to them. So here we see when Messiah comes back and completes the work of redemption and salvation and brings us into the land, that we are going to be sent out from being prisoners of this world with gifts, the plundering of the nations. And after receiving these gifts, Naomi tells Ruth that she says, "My daughter, wait until you know how this matter falls, for the man is not going to rest until he's completed the matter this day." And that right there, this day, prophetically is a hint at Yemot HaMashiach. Messiah is not going to relent during the time of Yemot HaMashiach until the whole house of Israel is gathered in, and then he's going to bring us out of the nations and restore us to our inheritance. All right. Chapter 4, the showdown at the gate. So the first thing that starts off is Boaz comes to the gate of the city and gathers 10 elders. Once again, the number 10. We saw that in the 10 years of that Mahlon and Chilion were married to Orpah and Ruth. Remember, 10 represents the 10 tribes of Israel. So he brings them to the gate and calls out, Paloni Almoni comes by, and Boaz calls him over for this confrontation. And this confrontation happens actually within the two gates. They've done some recent excavation in Israel and found that settlements in those time frames would actually have two gates where a party would come into the city and they would be stuck between these two gates, and it was a place where they would inspect that caravan to make sure that, you know, they weren't hiding soldiers or something bad, and then they'd be allowed in the rest of the city. Now, this was also a place that was used for gathering for courts, for parties. You know, it was a social gathering place. So here Boaz enters into a trial against Paloni Almoni. He's very shrewd about it. He asked Paloni Almoni if he would like to redeem the land. And Paloni Almoni's like, "Hey, I want the land." So he says, "Of course I'll do it." And then Boaz throws in, "Oh, well, hey, by the way, you're going to have to marry Ruth the Moabite." And immediately Paloni Almoni goes, "Oh, whoa, wait. I do not want to mess up my inheritance. So how about you go ahead and redeem her? I'll, you know, just step aside. So a very, very interesting encounter here, because we can kind of see this in a very messianic light. Boaz defeats Palonialmoni with something that comes forth from his mouth, his words. In the end times, Yeshua is going to defeat the adversary with a sword, a double-edged sword that comes out of his mouth. Let's see, where was I going else with that? All right, let's just go on. Here we go. Palonialmoni is afraid of losing his inheritance. Very interesting. Palonialmoni is only interested in the land. He did not want to redeem the people. I think we'll actually cover this in a couple minutes here. And then the deal is sealed when Palonialmoni gives Boaz his shoe. Now, according to the book that I've been reading by Rabbi Dr. Meir Levine, the Shelah blessing of the Merkat HaShachar, or the morning blessing, suggests that the wearing of leather shoes symbolizes a man's mastery over his environment. That's because the animal kingdom is supposed to give a tribute to mankind. That shows the subjugation of the animal kingdom. So, by casting off a shoe made of leather and giving it to another person, this symbolizes giving up this mastery and power and renouncing one's claim on part of the world. So now, with that knowledge in mind, when Moshe came into the burning bush and Yahweh told him to remove his sandals, that makes perfect sense. Yahweh's on this portion of the earth here, and this belongs to him. If Moshe would have walked on that land with his leather sandals, that would have been essentially suggesting that Moshe owned that land where Yahweh was at. But Yahweh says, no, you take off your shoes because this is my land. I own it. You do not have any claim to my land. All right. So, moving on to the two redeemers here in this showdown, Boaz and Palonialmoni. Interesting. Rabbinic commentators perceive that Palonialmoni is representing Messiah ben Yosef. If you remember from part one of the series, I talked about the concept of two messiahs, Messiah ben Yosef and the Messiah ben David. Now, we know that our master Yeshua actually is both of those messiahs. They just did not understand that it was the same person in two different comings. So Judaism believes that Messiah ben Yosef is supposed to reunite the tribes, but ultimately die and fail to bring redemption. So they see Palonialmoni bowing out as being Messiah ben Yosef. Well, I have to completely disagree with that, because not only, my understanding that Yeshua comes twice, and that Boaz in the pit represents, in the threshing floor represents Messiah at his first coming, and then this judgment represents Messiah at his second coming. But more importantly, we look at the character of Palonialmoni. He's a nobody, intentionally. And to me, he reminds me a lot more of Bar Kokhba. He's completely interested in redeeming the land. He's all about getting the land back, but he has absolutely no interest in getting the bride back. He's not want Ruth. Bar Kokhba was not interested in the redeeming the lost house of the sheep of Israel. He just wanted his own kingdom, or Judah's kingdom, to be established. And likewise, the Antichrist, the Anti-Messiah, what is he interested in? Him and his forces, they all want the land of Jerusalem, but they don't want the Jews and everyone else in covenant with Yahweh. They don't want Yahweh's people in the land. They just want the land for themselves. So Palonialmoni is obviously a false Messiah here that Boaz defeats. So the two redeemings of Boaz, like I was just talking about, Boaz first has a private, personal redemption with Ruth on the pit of the threshing floor. And if we go to Job 33, verse 28, he has redeemed my being from going down to the pit and my life from seeing light. You know, obviously that's kind of can be tied in here that Ruth went down to the pit and Boaz redeemed her from the pit. This private personal redemption that Yeshua did. And then the second coming of Yeshua, or the second coming of Boaz, the second redeeming, is a public trial, a judgment, not of the bride, but against the false suitor, the Poloni Almoni, the guy who could have been, you know, who was in a way wooing her, but not, but wasn't actually interested. He just wanted the land. So judgment is seen on him. And, you know, this usage of Poloni Almoni kind of goes back and reminds me of Isaiah 14, verse 12. 14, verse 12 through 17. Oh, how you have fallen from heavens, O Lucifer, son of the morning. You have been cut down to the ground. You have been laid low, or you have laid low the Gentiles. For you have said in your heart, let me go up to the heavens, and let me raise my throne above the stars of El, and let me sit in the mount of meeting on the sides of the north, and let me go up above the heights of the clouds. Let me be like the Most High. But you are brought down to the grave, to the sides of the pit. Those who see you stare at you and ponder over you and say, is this the man who made the whole earth tremble, who shook the rains, who made the world as a wilderness and destroyed its cities, who would not open the house of the prisoners? So you can kind of see the people are like, this is it. This is the, you know, they see Satan, you know, unveiled, and he's like, they're like, this is it? This is all this guy has? And I kind of see that's kind of what Poloni Almoni is. He's just like, hey, look at this guy. You know, he's a nobody. He's no one important. All right. So the end of Ruth, chapter 4, ends with Boaz rectifying the sins of his great-great-great-great-great-uncle Onan, who refused to give his brother seed. You know, if you remember the story of Judah and Tamar, Ur died, and then Onan was supposed to perform the Levirate duty, but he refused to, and so he was killed. So Boaz he rectifies those past wrongs. Likewise, Yeshua rectifies the sins of the first Adam by redeeming his bride. Adam, who should have redeemed his bride, because, you know, remember, Eve took the fruit, and Adam was standing right there with her. And so what he should have done is, instead of joining her in death, he should have redeemed her at that point. So Yeshua in the future rectifies that wrong. And we can make that connection with Boaz and Onan, because when we go to the genealogy, it starts out with, these are the generations of Peretz. And you know, remember, Peretz was the offspring of Tamar and Judah. So with, you know, there's an obvious connection there that we're supposed to see Tamar and Judah in this whole story of Ruth. So this in this chapter is actually where it's mentioned that Ruth was originally the husband of Mahlon. Now, if you remember, Mahlon means sickly. What did Yeshua come to do? Yeshua came to heal the sick, especially the lepers. They, you know, and sickness, physical sickness, represents a spiritual problem. So if Yeshua came to heal the sick and Boaz came to redeem Mahlon, he came to redeem this, you know, sick people. So another obvious connection there with the Messiah. And then Ruth, who is, remember we talked about Ruth and Naomi were essentially a blood sisterhood together. They were very close. And they rectify the infighting of Rachel and Leah. And that's why the people at the gate say, Yahweh make the woman who is coming to your house like Rachel and Leah. Ruth is compared there because she fulfilled what Rachel and Leah should have done. They shouldn't have been fighting, trying to have more kids than the other one. They should have been in unity. This book of Ruth is all about unity. Shavuot is about bringing the kingdom together instead of breaking it apart like we've done for so many years. And as a result of this, Ruth, the Moabitess, becomes the great-grandmother of King David. It's kind of interesting. Boaz is actually listed in the genealogy as being, the male figure instead of Mahlon, who technically was, according to the Levirate marriage rules, he was the father of Obed. So how do we rectify that? Well, if you go into and look at ancient Near Eastern practices, often the Redeemer would also adopt that son. So that son would not only inherit the deceased husband's lands, he would also inherit the new husband's lands as well, assuming the new husband didn't have any other children. So that's kind of interesting because, Boaz adopted Obed, and Yosef, the father or the husband of Miriam, adopted Yeshua in all likelihood as his own son. All right, so that wraps up part two of this teaching. I hope you've enjoyed this, and I hope to see you back for part three. Shalom.